Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Listeners probably know my first guest, Matthew Rhys, best for his leading role in the recently concluded FX drama, The Americans. But when Matthew isn't playing an undercover KGB agent, he is traveling around Europe with his friend and fellow actor, Matthew Good, for The Wine Show. Together, the two visit some of the world's greatest vineyards in order to find the best wine the continent has to offer, as well as satisfy their own curiosity about all things vino-related. The Wine Show is currently in its second season, and Matthew Rhys is here in studio. Hi.
Good morning.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you again.
So, The Wine Show, how'd you manage that gig?
You know, listening to your brief then, if you were to approach any producer and say, look, I have these two monkeys who just act for a living, but they want to drink wine around Europe. This is how they want to do it. I think you'd be thrown out of any pitch meeting. But strangely enough, that's what we did. We went to Italy and traveled around drinking wine.
So you guys, just as friends, did this initially. You'd had a couple glasses and said, should we get a TV show, mate?
Well, no. It did come about slightly, you know. I gave you that spin. But Matthew has a brother-in-law who's a very good TV producer and an incredible wine connoisseur himself, and wanted to make a show about wines. And I think was pitching it to Matthew. And Matthew therefore said, when, you know, they said, what we would need is two people who like wine but don't know anything about it. Goody very kindly went, I know just the person along with myself.
So what was your relationship to wine before this show?
Exactly that. I liked it. I knew nothing about it.
Did you just buy it looking at the label? Nice label, honey.
You know, I was that person who always went, listen, if it's French, we might be okay. That was about it. And that's pretty much still what I do.
So another part of the show, which is really fun, and I can see the kid in you when you do this, is when you get to learn about wine gadgets.
Yes.
That's a big part of it. So out of all the gadgets, what are we talking about, first of all? What kind of gadgets have you encountered?
Oh, everything and anything. It's like how to travel with your wine, how to carry it, how to drink it. Shirts that will repel red, white shirts that will repel red wine. Any matter of you know, corkscrews, just everything, aerators, things to get into wine, you name it.
Which is one you've thought, that is genius? I can't believe I've lived my life not knowing about this gadget.
The white shirt that can repel red wine is what I thought was like, at last, we found a true aid to people like myself.
Do you remember why that is and how that is?
Yes, he did explain to it, but there's so much science involved. I kind of, after the first few words, I lost interest in it. Look, If red wine runs off like a duck's back, I'll buy it.
There you go. It's probably something from some space program.
Yes, you know that's what happened at NASA. They were, you know, they were celebrating something. Somebody threw wine and went, hang on, this didn't stain. We're in.
Genius.
Yeah.
What is one thing, one gadget you've encountered you thought, well, that's just ridiculous? There's got to be at least one.
Yes, I'm trying to think. There was this one, I can't even remember what it's called. You know when you get the Jeroboams, the kind of 2.5 bottles, mm-hmm. and you can put it in, you place it in this thing, and you turned a wheel and it would slowly pour. But the speed at which it poured, I just thought, you'd go crazy by the time it actually gave you a full glass. You just might as well do it yourself or get a straw. I'm trying to think if there's
anything
else.
That's a pretty good one.
Not to discount the engineering of it, but it was a little slow in pouring.
We're talking to Matthew Rhys about The Wine Show. So what's a typical shooting of an episode? How does that work?
I would genuinely like to tell you, I have no recollection of those weeks. I have to be honest. I was just discussing why it was when in Italy we weren't spitting the wine upon tasting. And on the first day we were with a winemaker in Italy, and we tasted his wine, then we spat, and he was incredibly offended because he said, in Italy, I don't know, listen, he might have been lying to us, or this may be truth, but he said, in Italy, you don't spit the wine, you should drink two long drafts of wine. One is to clear your palate, the second one you will taste. I think he sniffed at the fact that you can't properly enjoy or taste wine if you're not swallowing it. Therefore, myself and Matthew Good, for the rest of the month, drank everything that passed our lips. So I would like to tell you what the average shooting day was, but I've no idea.
There must be amazing outtakes.
There is, and they've shown us to, and they're very embarrassing.
Now you know what you look like when you're a little.
It's terrifying.
Friendly.
Yes, when you think your conversation is at its scintillating best, you have nothing to say, and the producer's saying things like "use short words and don't slur."
Oh, that's so funny. This just sounds like the best job ever.
It is, to a point. And then what you try and do is, after about the third day, and listen, believe me, I've tried to complain about this job several times and people have punched me and thrown things and told me to go away. But when you say, look, you get up 8:30 and you start drinking wine, and you stop drinking wine at 7:30 p.m.
Yeah.
And you have to find something interesting or new or original to say about each of those wines. But, you know, the producer's then saying things like, stop saying it's nice. Come up with another superlative. It gets hard. Waking up with a hangover every day.
You have a guy in the show, Joe.
Yes.
Tell us about Joe.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, as we call him, Joe Fattorini. There's nothing he doesn't know about wine or making of wine, storing, carrying, wine history. He's encyclopedic and a little terrifying in his capacity for drinking wine and still being very eloquent about it. But yes, he guided us through the greater subtleties of what wine can be.
Will you share with us some of the things that you learned?
I would love to. Once again, sadly, I have no recollection. Believe me, that is the greatest question. When I said and did, listen, I'm doing this thing called the wine show.
Hilarious.
Everyone goes, oh, great. Give me some tips. I go, no idea. Okay, just tell me a wine to drink. So I couldn't tell you. I literally, at the end of this, because I came away going, I know nothing about wine. I've retained nothing. I said to Joe Fattorini, I said, listen, we're literally going to the airport. I said, I don't remember much about this month at all. What's the one thing I should take away from Italy? He said, it's very simple. If you're ever in doubt, dinner party, special occasion, anything like that, take a Chianti Classico and make sure the black cockerel is on the bottle.
That's a great piece of advice.
That's the only thing I retain from a month of drinking and learning about wine in Italy.
I feel like I should ask you about hangover cures. That might be better.
Beer. We found out that one of the only things to do was a cleansing ale because it was the only thing that you could segue into an 8:30 a.m. glass of wine.
So now if someone comes to your house with a bottle of wine,
yeah,
can you tell if it's good or bad now?
No, but what I can do now is feign this kind of facade of going, oh, interesting. Because everyone goes, how is this for wine? And you just go, oh, that is interesting. Yeah. Interesting was, as you can tell, a word I wildly overused.
Now, have you folks thought about season three, about going to Australia, going someplace else?
We have, obviously. Now there's three of us in the loop. There's myself, now James Purefoy, and Matthew Good. So I'm hoping it'll be like the three amigos on wine. So obviously we're passionately discussing where in the world we would like to go and inebriate.
Now, how do you folks work that with all of your schedules? You guys are all very busy working people.
Well, we tell people we are. It is a little tricky at the moment. I think the greater problem is telling our better halves that we would like to leave them and the children for a long period of time to go to a foreign country and drink.
Yeah, that wouldn't go over so big.
It never does. So this is still a work in progress.
I want to congratulate you guys. You are Mr. It's award season.
Oh, thank you.
Award season. You got a nominee for Golden Globe, the SAG Award this morning for Ensemble.
Ensemble, that was great.
I've often heard actors say that the SAG Award nomination, Screen Actor Guild, that's really the award that means something to them.
Of course, it's your peers. So it's absolutely the one, you know, we're always, I think anyone in show business is part of a, you know, one of the puppies in the litter that wasn't licked enough. So when your peers kind of, you know, recognize your work, then that's exactly what you want.
We're talking to Matthew Rhys, one of the co-hosts of The Wine Show, and also an actor. When he's not drinking wine, he acts sometimes.
Sometimes I do both.
So what is it about this award show season? It's so interesting. It just seems like it's super condensed. Is it at all enjoyable? How do you get through it? How do you pace yourself? How do you sit through every junket?
That's all fine. Listen, the nominations, being nominated is incredible. You know, in the run-up to these things, when you hear actors saying, oh, being nominated is incredible, I realize now they're actually saying it's true that what they're saying. It's fantastic to be nominated and to be invited to the big prom. But sitting through the ceremony itself, it's duplicitous, because as much as you want to win, the terror of going up in front of that audience and giving a speech, because ultimately you're doing something you haven't rehearsed, and in front of all your peers and very famous people, it's absolutely terrifying.
Have you ever made a professional connection that worked out at one of these award shows? Because I've heard actors say this, especially younger actors, like, this is a great opportunity. I'm going to stand up and Steven Spielberg's going to see me. He would have never thought of me for this part.
No, I don't. No, that isn't quite going through my mind. When I was very fortunate to win the Emmy this year, what was going through my mind in that moment was literally trying to remember everyone's name who had got me to that place. And then I spectacularly forgot my agents.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
They won't hold it against. That's got to be a really mind-bending experience, too.
It is and was. I was literally trying to stop my knees from shaking.
Yeah. So the Americans, I'm curious why you think this show has made such an imprint on people. People are really mourning the end of it.
Yeah, as are we. And I think it was a show about a relationship at the end of the day, a relationship that was, you know, intensified and put under a microscope. It was everything that I think that couple went through. Mm-hmm. I think people go through day to day, but obviously ours was on a far more intense level. So I think it was relatable in that, you know, the backdrop was a world of espionage and that made it exciting. But ultimately, they dealt with very universal themes.
And it is amazing to think how prescient it was. A decade ago, have you said, like, we're going to have a show about two people who pretend to be Americans? And then given everything that's happened in the past 3 years.
Well, not just 7 years ago. I remember when we first went to air and a journalist said to me, is Russian interest in the US still relevant? And I thought, oh, no, we're not going to make it past season one. And then look what happened.
This crazy world we're in.
Sadly.
So Americans was 6 seasons, right?
Yes.
And you were on Brothers and Sisters for 5 seasons.
Correct.
When you are involved in these long runs, what do you like about that as an actor? Sometimes people say it's hard to kind of sustain it, but I have to imagine there's something that's positive about it.
Absolutely. It's the luxury, the indulgence of that time, because, you know, in especially in feature films, I always find the pressure of going, you have these 2 hours or this one arc to get this absolutely right once. And I find in television, you have another opportunity. You get another opportunity to come back the next week with a possibly different storyline, and you can keep developing and digging and digging foundations. Just the time of it is incredibly luxurious.
We're speaking with Matthew Rhys. We started out talking about the wine show, but he can't remember half of it because he drank so much wine, which meant it was good wine. So at least when you watch the show, you'll know the wine was good and he was enjoying himself.
Yes.
We talked about the Americans a little bit. Death and Nightingales. What's that?
That was...
I've only seen the trailer because it's on the BBC, but
yes.
It looks amazing.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear. It's based on a novel by Eugene McCabe about... I always find it slightly difficult trying to pitch this properly because it's about three people, and I try not to use the word triangle, but I've just used it.
Okay.
And I certainly won't use the word love next to it. It's about many things. It's obviously, I'll talk about from my character's point of view, a Protestant landowner who married a Catholic woman who passed on, and then she had a child that he raised. That child goes on to develop a relationship she probably possibly shouldn't with someone else, and I'm not happy about it. That's not the best pitch you'll ever hear about it, but it's my point of view on it.
But it also looks very mysterious, and it's the way it was filmed. There's like so much texture to it. It seems like it would be, it drew me in, just visually.
Oh, good. Yes, it is. It's certainly tense. It's very layered. It's very, it's at times very suspenseful. Absolutely. And it, you know, it's not a kind of MTV pop video. It takes the time it deserved. I mean, I think one of the comments I think that's been coming out of the UK is like they've enjoyed the time that's been given to it, that in this day and age where, you know, we see so much editing every few seconds, yeah, that this one has been allowed to breathe. And I think as a result of that, the kind of the tension is built
in a greater way.
Now, you're also in the project about Mr. Rogers, right? The biopic, and you play the journalist sent to find out everything you can about Fred Rogers, who's being played by Tom Hanks. First of all, did you understand how important Mr. Rogers was?
I did, because I'd seen the documentary, You Are My Friend. So, and obviously when I'd seen it, you know, I saw, and Kerry had given me the context as to
who this person was. you're not from America. And for people sort of our vintage, Mr. Rogers was really important to our development as children.
Yes, and understandably so. And the research I've done on him consequently, exactly that word development was instrumental. So yes, it's been a learning curve for me at the same time as it's been a kind of making of a feature film.
Now, is your character a good guy or bad guy in this film?
Well, that all depends on opinion, doesn't it? But what's great about it is that you see an incredible journey he goes on through and because of Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. And a great part of it is based on truth as well, about this journalist, Tom Juno, from Esquire magazine. And that's basically what the film is based on.
And we met about a year ago when you had just, The Post had just come out.
Yes.
You played Daniel Ellsberg.
Yes.
And I know that was a really important role for you and that you did a lot of research for it. If you wouldn't mind sharing, I know this story because I asked you this a year ago, but can you tell folks why that was really important and what you admired about him?
Oof, there's a number of reasons. Excuse me. I think one of the things that struck me was when I met him, his passion was still as vehement today as it was all those years ago when he realized that what he needed to do was try and make the world a better place. And his bravery, you know, in the research I did about Daniel Ellsberg, what I realized was the act of bravery in what he did was enormous because no one had ever done this before. He was the pioneer of the, you know, of that world where he saw an incredible injustice and went, I will do something personally and take on that monster. What was the specific story that I told you?
I can't remember what it was. I didn't go back and look at the interview.
Okay.
I didn't want to take all the old questions and give them to you again. But I remember we had a conversation just about that idea of, I think, someone being brave enough. That
yes.
He would take these government secrets because he thought it would make his country better.
Yes.
Even though it was technically a treasonous or espionage or whatever you want to call
it. Yes. But the other thing is, he said, is that ultimately an inordinate amount of people were dying. And that's what was wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's what he meant. I can't live with that on my conscience and therefore did something about it.
Yeah, I drink a lot of wine between now and then.
Before
I let you go, how is family life? You're a New Yorker now, yeah?
It's, you know, I don't know where to begin. It's, you know, you just like the roller coaster every day of raising a child in New York. And you can, it still blows my mind that I have a son who is born in Brooklyn, we'll say he's New York, and, you know, we walk the Brooklyn Bridge very often, and I kind of go, this will be his square mile, which to me is like the scene from a movie. To him will be home. So I love it. It's crazy, but I love it.
They're so funny like that. My son, for the first time, is taking the subway to school, and because we used to walk to his school, and I said, Isaac, are you going to be okay taking the subway? He went, I'm a New Yorker, Mom.
That's all you want to hear.
That's the thing, right?
Yeah, it's all you want to hear. Because they'll be okay.
I'm so glad you came by to talk to us about The Wine Show.
So am I. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to see you again. The Wine Show airs Thursdays at 10 p.m. on Ovation TV. When we come back, we'll get the story behind those fabulous and festive lights that adorn the outer boroughs, especially Diker Heights during the holiday season. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Joining me in studio is Richard Hake with some details on a breaking news story. Michael Cohen's been sentenced?
That's right. President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, sentenced to 3 years in prison for tax evasion, lying to Congress, and violating campaign finance laws. Cohen appeared in federal court in Manhattan this morning for sentencing. He pleaded guilty to misleading Congress about a plan to build a Trump skyscraper in Moscow and orchestrating payments month to two women who said they had affairs with Trump. He also dodged $1.4 million in taxes. Now, New York prosecutors had pushed for a substantial prison term. Cohen's lawyers argued for leniency here since he's cooperated with federal investigators, including special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the election. Now, Cohen, at his sentencing, says he takes full responsibility for the crimes he admitted to, but he went on to say that his allegiance to Trump led him to take a path of darkness instead of light. And now the judge, he said, this is Judge William H. Pauley, said Cohen deserved modest credit for his decision over the summer to admit guilt and cooperate in the federal investigation. But he says somewhere along the way, Mr. Cohen appears to have lost his moral compass. And the judge went on to say, as a lawyer, Mr. Cohen should have known better. Now he begins serving the sentence March 6th.
All right. At 12:27 Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday, has the president tweeted yet?
No, we've been waiting, but not yet.
All right. Richard Hake, thank you for the update.
Thanks.
It's holiday season. I want to talk lights. For a fleeting magical moment each year, domestic architecture in New York City's outer boroughs is transformed into fantasyscape of lucid luminosity and holiday extravaganzas. I really wish I wrote that, but I didn't. Our next guest did. He is, of course, describing the result of people climbing on rooftops, wrapping hundreds of lights around trees, anchoring giant blow-up characters to the lawn, creating festivals of light, adding some music, and generally bringing joy to their neighborhoods with holiday displays. And in the case of neighborhoods like Diker Heights in Brooklyn, it's not just the neighbors. People come from all over to drive around and take in some of the most amazingly decorated homes ever. One of our producers went there last weekend, and you can see some of her pictures on our Instagram page at All of It WNYC. Joseph Shior is the author of Built with Faith, Italian American Imagination and Catholic Material Culture in New York City. He's also the director of academic and cultural programs at John D. Calandra Italian American Institute, a Queens College CUNY research institute. Thank you so much for coming in. We're very excited to talk about all of these lights.
Thank you for having me.
So for folks who have never actually physically gone to Diker Heights, can you set the scene, what it's like this time of year?
Sure. So we're talking the blocks around 84th, 83rd Street, somewhere around 10th Avenue, 13th Avenue. And you have a coterie of houses, private homes, on single lots of land that have been decorated with scores, hundreds, thousands of lights, pulsating lights. You have various types of figurines, often mechanical figurines. And you have these tourists that are all over there as well. So they become part of the whole scene. That's part of what's going on in places like Diker Heights, but also in Canarsie, places in Staten Island. It's, you know, not unique to one neighborhood, but happening all over the city, up in the Bronx as well.
And in your book, you make this point that these cultural objects become sort of the focus of community.
Yes, yes.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, Christmas is very much about this relationship between the private, the domestic, the family, having meals and the nostalgia of the past. But it's also about being out there in the public, about shopping, about Black Friday, mm-hmm. about going on Fifth Avenue to the department stores and storing all their scenes. So there's this kind of tension and mix between between various aspects of the holiday. And so with the Christmas house displays, it sort of brings it all together. Here's these private homes that sort of operate to some degree like a department store, but they're not commercial. They're not really there to sell you anything. They're this kind of altruistic gift that private individuals make to their neighborhood and then ultimately to the city at large.
What's the balance between the religious and just the celebratory?
Sure.
The frosty.
Sure. Like all of Christmas, you know, there is this kind of strange balance that's going on, and people are always constantly negotiating. You could take part in Christmas and sort of more or less avoid the commercial, but you could be part of the commercial and not have any religious aspect to it at all. So many of the people that I interviewed in places like Diker Heights talk about the origins of their individual house displays with the manger scene, mm-hmm. The Holy Family sort of there in the manger scene. And so from there, they actually begin to create these things. And some of these go back to the 1960s, really takes off in the 80s and 90s. The other thing that people told me about, which you normally don't get in the sort of journalistic accounts of the house displays, is that people often started them as vows, that if my family member was healed, I would do this Christmas display. And that's a sort of very old Catholic tradition of making an offering for a miraculous healing or a miraculous event. So there is that element to it that often is not visible, because what people see is the pulsing lights, the Grovers, the Snoopies, and whatnot.
Sure. You write in your book about this, these displays being somewhat of a post-World War II phenomenon, and largely in Italian-American neighborhoods. Now, we don't want to make any gross generalizations, but why were they starting in Italian neighborhoods?
Sure. Christmas house displays, I have to say, is pervasive throughout the United States. Everybody does this. This is not unique to Italian Americans. But for a particular reason, conditions in New York City, Italian Americans really emerged as a group of people who really took this on. I think there are a number of reasons. One is that there is this older tradition of creating a miniature landscape, nativity landscape, called the Presepio, that is not just the nativity. It is this sprawling, miniature landscape with shepherds and sheep and marketplaces and towns and squares that, you know, could take the size of a finished basement. So it's not a big leap to go from the Presepio to the Christmas house displays. Also, there is this sort of older tradition within Italian-American Catholic religious life of the lights that arch across the streets for the big street feasts that you see in San Gennaro.
So
that stuff sort of comes together. But I think what happens is that in places like Diker Heights and Canarsie's, that people finally are able to achieve at a certain point after World War II enough income to buy a house. And as they become increasingly more American, and this sort of great American tradition that is really sweeping after World War II across the country, because now companies are creating all these kind of mechanicals and figurines, they sort of buy into that and create it part of their sort of Italian-American identity in New York City.
We're talking to Joseph Sciorra, author of Built with Faith, Italian-American Imagination and Catholic Material Culture in New York City. You also mentioned that these displays are a marriage of working-class values and middle-class success. Can you explain that?
Sure. Earlier on, a lot of people were physically involved in creating these displays. I was really fortunate as a kid to see what people say is the first big New York City Christmas house display, which is by this guy called Joseph Olivia, out in Marine Park. And he built all of the mechanical rides by himself, right? And so as people began to see that and be inspired by it, they began to create it. So eventually what happens, though, is there's a guy called Lou Nasty, N-A-S-T-I, and he creates a company where he creates mechanical displays for the department stores, but people in various neighborhoods tap into him and start hiring him to create it. So there's a desire to show off their building skills, their manual labor, but that sort of decreases as the decades go on. But what really gets sort of put on front view is the fact that they have enough money to be able to buy all these lights, to pay for the electrical bill, and to hire people to create these various mechanicals and displays for them.
Yeah, let's talk about the finances of all this. How much do people spend, and how high can the electric bills go?
Yeah, they go hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars. I haven't gotten into the details of all everybody's bills, but I mean, people talk about rewiring their homes so that they can handle this increase for the 1 month and a half in the year where their bills just skyrocket. So this is something that's a kind of concern from them. But again, people see it as, and or they talk about it as, a gift to the community. They want to give back. And, you know, there's a tension between how these things are perceived and what people say they're trying to do. And I think that tension between a gift for the neighborhood, for the city at large, and sort of nouveau riche kitsch is something that's always going on in the sort of in the media about how they're talked about.
Is there any sort of danger or hazard, be it fire hazard, be it crowd control, and are any sort of agencies involved with that?
I haven't heard of any reports. What you do hear is that there are some neighbors in various neighborhoods who do complain about the traffic, and also the traffic of buses, and now you get, I mean, you get tour buses coming in here. A friend of mine just came in from Europe, and he was staying in Times Square, and the hotel in Times Square advertised tours to Diker Heights as part of the various things you can see, Ellis Island, mm-hmm. Statue of Liberty, Diker Heights lights. So there are complaints about that. There's no, I haven't really heard about any kind of danger to mm-hmm. to visitors of the like, but it can get very crowded around this time of year in places like Diker Heights. That's why I always visit after Christmas because they usually stay up until
Epiphany, right?
They stay up until the Epiphany.
So somebody now is thinking, I gotta go. I have to see this. Can you help us plan a trip? What do I need to know if I say I want to go out to Diker Heights?
Well, one thing is probably to have a vehicle because it's not the closest place to a subway stop. There are various tours that one can take. There's even bike tours that people organize from Manhattan. And you want to, if you have a car, you want to be able to park it a little bit away from the sort of the epicenter of the Diker Heights lights and just be prepared to be dazzled.
You mentioned the media narrative, and sometimes you all get caught up in the media narrative and people keep reporting the same story over and over again. Yeah. What do you think is underreported about this or that the media doesn't quite get right that you'd like people to know?
Yeah, I think what doesn't get reported enough is the religious aspect, as we discussed, mm-hmm. and the idea that people see this as an altruistic aspect of Christmas, something that they are giving. But I think the other thing that's really important, and the media is part of this, is the way in which, especially in a place like Diker Heights, is how these Christmas lights have come to define the neighborhood. I mean, these are neighborhoods which the housing stock is not particularly all that interesting. And the neighborhood has commercial thoroughfares that attract some people, but it's not a sort of destination site. The Christmas lights displays are the things that have come to define Diker Heights. You go on Wikipedia and you look up Diker Heights, and Christmas lights are what mm-hmm. is the sort of major defining element of the neighborhood. So that these displays, these installations help to create a sense of community and a sense of identity, a sort of place consciousness for neighborhoods that are not particularly on the cultural map of New York City.
Joseph Shira, thanks for all the context.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. When we come back, we'll talk to Milo Ventimiglia, who plays Jack Pearson on This Is Us. He's in a new movie with Jennifer Lopez called Second Act, and we'll hear from the film's director, Peter Sagal, as well. Stay with us. All of it will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Here's a line from a new movie. I just wish we lived in a world where street smarts equaled book smarts. That's the wish of a lead character in the new movie Second Act. Maya is a 40-something woman, smart as a whip, but without a fancy piece of paper from a fancy school. It's something that keeps her from getting the promotion she rightly deserves. And to her nerdy godson, who doctors up her resume, giving her a Wharton Business School degree, a Facebook page filled with pictures of meet and greets with President Obama, you get the idea. She manages to land a high-powered job of her dreams, and she's supported by her family and her loyal boyfriend, played by Milo Ventimiglia. Hi, Milo.
How's it going?
Good. The comedy poses some serious questions about class and perception. By the way, Maya also happens to be played by powerhouse Jennifer Lopez, so there's that. And the film is set to be released in theaters on December 21st, and its director Peter Sagal and Milo Ventimiglia are here. Hi, guys.
How's it going?
Hello. Good. It's good. So, Peter, you said this movie's a departure from your usual work. Why did you decide to tell this story at this time?
First of all, I'm from a house filled with women. And they were kind of tired of me doing, you know, just the dude movies. And it was time to get in touch with my feminine side. That, plus the fact that this movie kind of harkens back to one of my favorite kinds of films that are not being made anymore. A Mike Nichols movie, for example, comes mm-hmm. to mind, obviously Working Girl. But Elaine May and Nora Ephron and that kind of story combined with Jen, plus the timing of, you know, the Me Too moment and female empowerment, it just felt like the right time.
So it's pretty significant to have a working class woman of color at the center of a film. Did you keep that in mind, or how did you keep that in mind as you started to tell this story?
Well, that obviously is what sets this movie apart. Plus, there's a surprise in it that, you know,
we won't give away.
you think it's going to be one kind of story and it turns into something else. But, you know, Jen has said that this character really reflects who she is and the same kind of struggles that she's had coming up in the business where she was told she couldn't do it and she wanted to prove she could. And I love stories like that, you know, second chances and underdog stories.
And also, she mentioned she's a producer on this film, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So she's the boss lady. Mm-hmm. By the way, I read this interesting observation about the movie. Mm-hmm. It said, it described as a fun, heartfelt rom-com. And then it said, the film has something to say, at least glancingly, about class prejudice in the real world.
Oh, wow.
So what do you think about that in terms of what the film says about class prejudice?
I mean, look, I'm a college dropout as well, so I understand somebody saying, hey, you can't move forward in life or do something bigger because you don't have that degree. I feel like I've done pretty well just by observing the world around me. Class difference, you know, if we kind of strip away what possibly we're born into, or that idea that, you know, you come from different stock and all of a sudden that kind of sets you in a better pace, a better place. Mm-hmm. I think we just need to look at individuals and their merit and their worth and what they can actually do and accomplish.
You mentioned that you felt that yourself. Would you mind sharing a time when...
For me it was a little more petty. It was a little more, you know, peers and whatnot that had that degree that were graduates of a fine arts program saying, you know, you're going to regret finishing up school. You're going to regret not actually doing anything. Like, how is that going to help you in the business and in the career? And I was like, I don't really see the point of it. I'm out, I'm working, I'm busting my hump, I'm waiting tables, I'm working, sitting in snowboards, I'm working. And it's okay if somebody sees something in me and I'm able to prove to someone that I can do something based on my merit, you know, then great.
Did you jump right into acting from high school?
I did. I went to school for 4 years. I was at UCLA for 4 years.
Okay.
Before that I was at conservatory in San Francisco. But I'd kind of known since I was a kid that I wanted to be in it. And, you know, listen, the arts are very different than being a doctor. You're a doctor, go get a degree. You're an attorney, go get a degree. For me, it was always acting.
Another point this interesting sort of piece about your movie said is that honesty and taking chances are themes of this enjoyable rom-com. So the main character, Maya, mm-hmm. is lying through this mm-hmm. film about herself and about other things we find out later. How do you direct somebody to when they're lying?
Well, it's a good question because we knew we were on a slippery slope, because how do you like a character who is lying? So we carefully tiptoed around the fact that the lie was created by a friend of the family. And yes, she still had to harbor it and go along with it, but it was our entrance, our key into this sort of Cinderella world. And it's a genre. There are many movies, you know, that characters have had to lie to get into the door, but then it's what you do in there, and then the audience watches this cocktail of relationships unfold that they know, oh boy, when this lie is revealed, how is this going to go down? But keeping her likable along that journey, we had to have her friends constantly remind her, hey, this is BS. You know this is going to blow up. Why don't you just come clean now? And we had to, in the writing, craft how complicated it was and how it would hurt certain people's feelings. And maybe it was better. And you're always playing that balance of, mm-hmm. you know, when is the right time to get off the carousel of lies, and who's it going to hurt least? And so that we have to keep in mind the entire time.
And also for you as a director, I mean, you have Jennifer Lopez as a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. She's an industry in and of herself. And she's also super identifiable as Jennifer Lopez, right? So how did you, and what were the conversations like about getting her to Maya again, now that she's such a big star? I mean, back in the day in Out of Sight and some of the earlier films, she was on her way up. But I mean, she's just a giant star.
Right. Well, it's a very funny, reminds me of a moment that we were filming in Central Park. Talk about art imitating life. So yeah, we spent a lot of time, you know, you are this girl from Queens, you know, this is the Cinderella story. And as we're walking through Central Park, all of the sketch artists on the promenade have sketches of Jennifer Lopez. And I'm like, oh, you know, this is really, you're making this hard, New York. You know, I'm trying to get her out of this
Sorry,
show.
She's a hometown girl.
Yeah.
So what were some of the ways you worked around that?
You know, first of all, she's
a pro.
Yeah, as Milo knows, this girl is a phenomenal actor.
Yes.
And she is, both of these guys, Milo and her, are there, I call them Ferraris. you don't have to touch the gas. You know, they go, they're smooth, they're incredibly intuitive. And, you know, sometimes as a director, you think, well, I really need to craft this performance. What do I say? What brilliant words are going to come out of my mouth? Well, take one. And she was like, yeah, that's pretty good. I don't really know what else to say, but let's maybe try it this way or maybe try it one degree less. But she's pretty darn smart.
Well, maybe the wisdom of it is stepping back,
mm-hmm.
being wise enough to know, like, okay, we don't have to do it again.
Yeah. And as she said also in a lot of these interviews that I've been hearing lately, this is sort of a second act for her. She started out as an actress and then, ta-da, became this singer. And then, as the years went by, she became something bigger. It was like this brand. And it was Vegas and then all of these television shows. And then coming back to film was sort of this second act. It's been considered a little nostalgic, this kind of story and her in this story.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of cool.
We're talking to Peter Siegel. He directed Second Act, and Milo Ventimiglia stars in this new film. So you play the love interest.
I do.
A bit younger than Jennifer's character, although it's never really expressed directly.
No.
Did you talk about that in terms of the script? Was that ever part of it? There's a little bit of a subtext to it.
I never heard anything of it, but you know, I kind of tend to just say these are two people who are in love, mm-hmm. and they're making it work, and they aren't without their struggles and their differences and things like that. But when it comes down to it, here are two people that really, really genuinely love each other. So I never considered it, never thought about it.
That's interesting, because it's funny, in the script they discuss children, and uh-huh. I think maybe it's because I'm that her age, it's that subtext of like, oh, I can't have kids at a certain age. I thought that was sort of a mm-hmm. little bit of the mm-hmm. subtext. We won't give anything else away, but
yeah.
in the conversation.
Plus, just think about it. I think Alex Rodriguez is a couple years younger.
I think he's a year older than, I'm 41. I think Alex is 42, 43.
Yeah. I mean, she's dealing with it there. My wife is 3 years older than me, but a year ahead of herself in school. So 4 years ahead of me in school. So we're all kind of from that same.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Jen wanted you to play this part,
mm-hmm.
right? So you get the script. Aside from Jennifer Lopez wanting you to play this part, what really sang to you about it?
One, the message of the film, just, you know, everything that Pete was saying about, you know, female empowerment and kind of going and taking those moments that you believe you deserve to be in, that life you want to have, and not letting anyone else stand in your way of it. But then also, I saw this couple that really felt like a real couple, you know, and how Maya was relating to her friends in the situation and just wanting it all and then losing a few things along the way only to return back to where she was, feeling a lot more full as a human being. I just really loved it. I loved the story of it. And, you know, I'd been a fan of Pete's, and I'd been a fan of Jen's and everything. I was like, well, great. Let me take a tiny little break from the TV show I got and fly to New York and shoot a movie. And
you know, there were all these think pieces up in like 2016, 17 about the death of the rom-com. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen a good one. We haven't seen Reese Witherspoon or Sandy Bullock. And then all of a sudden this year, there were a couple that were really successful. You know, you had Crazy Rich Asians, mm-hmm. Netflix to All the Boys I Loved Before. Why do you think we're coming back around to rom-coms?
I think comedy is cyclical. And it constantly changes. As a matter of fact, I think that's why you probably see more dramatic directors working into their latter years, like Clint Eastwood, than you do comedic directors. Because, you know, what is fresh and what is hot? And at one point in the beginning of my career, it was joke book comedies like Naked Gun. And then there were a lot like that. And then there was the gross out phase and the Farrellys. And, you know, I did a Nutty Professor, which jumped on that bandwagon. And then there were the rom-coms. Then they went away. Now they're coming back. I'm sure they're going to go out of style, too, again. But I think they're a staple. I mean, you go back to Hepburn and Tracy, you know, Gable, you know, It Happened One Night. You're always going to have them. Crazy Rich Asians, which, by the way, I just saw and loved. I thought it was really a sweet story. And I thought to myself, yeah, why aren't there more movies like this? And I'm really glad. You know, let's face it, we've been in a superhero, I won't say rut, but we've, you know, there's a lot of superhero stuff. And I'm not saying that just because we're coming out against Aquaman, but but we are. So I'm glad that this is, if it's considered nostalgic and, you know, fine with me, that's awesome.
I also think the times are kind of dark and tough.
So you want something a little lighter. You want something a lot more fun, uplifting. This is a very uplifting film.
Something cozy.
Yeah.
Right? Especially wintertime.
Yeah.
We're talking with Peter Siegel and Milo Ventimiglia about their new film, Second Act. So you mentioned this, Milo. So you're working on This Is Us, which is so heavy and so textured and dark. And then you have this lovely, wonderful film. Were you doing it at the same time, or did you take a break?
No. We were doing it at the same time. Wow. So this time last year, or actually in November of last year, I was running back and forth between New York and Los Angeles. And while I was... While my character's home was burning down in Los Angeles, the Pearson home was burning down, I was hopping into a shower with Jennifer Lopez.
Welcome to your brain. Yes.
I know. Yeah. I know. What an amazing space to be in. But it was a nice balance, and it was a good welcome on each side, you know, to say, I'm going to get away from the heavy, really familial stuff that I'm working on This Is Us, and go spend some time a little more uplifted on Second Act.
But you don't know how hard this guy worked, because he was taking red eyes right and left. And if you remember that one night, we were shooting in the bar in Queens, and we were like right under the LaGuardia flight path. And every time we heard a plane, he looked up like, you know, little dog hearing, you know, a little sound of like, I gotta go home. That might be my plane. And you barely made it.
Yeah, I remember we had a hard out on set. I had to be off set by 8 o'clock to make, I don't know, like a 9 p.m. red eye. And there were, I was back on my set on This Is Us, I think 9 in the morning or whatever it was. It was a tight turnaround.
Yeah.
You know, but the crew was great. The crew moved and made sure that we had time as the creatives to get a couple takes. And like Pete was saying earlier, Jen is just, she's right there with you. She's always right there with you. You know, there's an actor who is prepared, but then there's an actor who's prepared and open to the experience of what they also see and feel in a scene, and that's Jennifer.
I think, you know, in the age of streaming and in the age of premium cable, I'm not sure people realize what a big deal it is for a network drama to break through the way This Is Us. And also, you guys do so many more episodes. You're up to 106 or 7 already. Something crazy.
Not quite that almost far. I think we maybe...
I think my DVR lied to me last night because I started going into the back ones.
I think we're in the high 70s right now.
But still, that's an enormous amount each year compared to these shows. There's 9 episodes.
Yeah.
How do you keep up that pace?
Oh, we're not in the 50s. No, we're in the 50s. Sorry.
I must have double recorded them
all. Yeah, you're watching them twice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're getting a different, your HD and SD.
I probably get,
probably.
Honestly, you're probably right.
Probably. we have amazing writers. We've got a great production team. And we have a group of talented artists that are wanting to be there, that show up prepared. Everyone shows up excited about what this show is. You know, I know I've stepped away to join Second Act or other films or other projects that I've done, but always going back to that, that's home.
Yeah.
That's home, the show.
Considering your character is dead, did you think you'd be around for this many seasons?
I knew I would be.
You did? They told you in the beginning?
Yeah,
okay.
No, Dan Fogelman, our boss, he basically said, I know you're dead since the beginning, but that doesn't mean anything. So, no, I get it. I said, listen, if you want to Ned Stark me, you want to lop my head off by the end of the season because you're not, you know, for whatever reason, just go ahead. It's okay. But, I love how our writers have been able to weave in the past and how it impacts the present day. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, even though I say to people, I said, you know, we really only known Jack Pearson for about, I don't know, 50 hours. There's still so much more life to go, even though he only lived 54 years. And that could be said for a lot of us. There are these small moments that maybe we kind of are out in the world or out in our families or out in our friends, but it's like, you know, we really all have lifetimes of discovery.
So Peter, what's next for you? We know what he's working on.
I literally just got back from Toronto, where I was filming an action comedy with Dave Bautista, the Drax from Guardians of the Galaxy, and for STX, and that comes out next year sometime.
And I have to say congratulations on the SAG Award nomination for Ensemble.
Oh,
for
yeah.
This Is Us. That
yeah,
happened yeah. this morning.
Sure.
You know, a lot of actors say that's the award that really matters to them, the SAG Award.
I mean, listen, it's a community of peers, and that's great. I mean, I've never been one to do it for the awards. I do it for guys like Pete. I do it for
Aww.
Co-stars like Jennifer. I do it for crews that show up every morning.
Crews, right?
Crews,
Those
my
guys.
God. You know, it's nice. I'm grateful. I'm humbled, but... I do it for the audience.
Milo Ventimiglia and Peter Sagal, thanks for being on us on our show. We appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Second act opens December 21st. You can listen to all of it on WNYC. We'll be right back.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.